This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show for your Monday. Good to be with you today. We got a humdinger of a week of shows. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to jinx anything. But I got to tell you, Thursday is going to be kind of fun around here. So we'll talk about that coming up here in a little bit. We are going to be having Joe Harrington is going to join us. If you did not see the editorial of the Minnesota Reformer, he and his organization, Our Streets Minneapolis, basically they're trying to push a fairly, I don't want to know if extreme, a very kind of huge change for Interstate 94, basically getting rid of Interstate 94 between, I think it says Marion, between Marion and 35W, but I mean, I think it's just basically throughout the entire Midway, including Cedar Riverside. It would just get rid of the, it would get rid of the interstate 94 east and west and replace it with a boulevard. We'll talk to him about that and kind of talk about some of the lingering questions his essay left out there that I think actually need to be addressed before we go down a path like that. That's coming up here in about a half an hour. Patrick, how are we today?
I'm a little bit in a little bit of a sour mood. I was a fan of Pee Wee Herman, so the death of Paul Rubens has been kind of tough today for me.
I'll touch on that coming up here in the 4 o'clock hour to start that hour off there. Yeah, but in case you did miss it, yes, and Paul Rubens had passed away. He's 70 years old, cancer. We'll talk more about him coming up here. I did this weekend go to Barbie. And I want to take a few minutes about two different things here. And it was interesting. So yesterday morning, I went to the showing at 11 o'clock at AMC in Southdale. I'll get back to that in a second. But I ran early that morning because I still am recovering. I got to kind of keep up with that, all that stuff. And I went and ran, and I was leaving the gym, and there's an older guy that was working the counter. I said, I hope you have a good plan for the day. I said, well, I'm about to get dragged inside to go watch the Barbie movie. And he goes, oh, I'm so sorry. And I said, really? He said, well, I didn't mean any offense or anything like that. I was like, well, no, it's not, but if you just, you know. It seems to be a pretty popular movie. I don't think there's a nefarious agenda. And I said, I got two daughters. They want to go to it. I'm not going to pass it up. I like pop culture stuff. What Greta Gerwig has done with that movie is stunning. As a matter of fact, I got to mention, my wife did not want to go see this movie. She thought it was going to be fairly, cheap. I mean, slapstick comedy, it's Barbie. Hey! And that sort of thing. And the same reason why it took me like 8 years before I finally watched Breaking Bad, because, when they introduced it, it's, Walter White, played by the guy from, the Freddie Muniz show. He'd done comedy and he was doing the show as Walter White. And it's the wacky hijinks of a meth dealer. You're like, okay, no. But then eventually everyone's like, okay, you got to go see it. So eventually I did. I'm like, wow, yeah, I missed. I should have been there from the get-go. The Barbie movie is very Barbie. Okay? It's very Barbie. I'm not ruining anything when I say they start the movie out in a phenomenal way, because I think one of the things that is lost, and I got to give Greta Gerwig a lot of credit here. This movie is sensational. They started off by basically doing this homage to 2001: A Space Odyssey, where basically they point out that before Barbie, all the dolls pretty much anyone played with were babies, and the point of playing was to teach you how to be a mom, and you care for your baby and all these things, and That was kind of what was set up. And then came Barbie. And all of a sudden, things changed dramatically. All of a sudden, it was a friend who was the cool friend, who was you know, wearing fashion, and it was doing her hair in fun ways and stuff like this. And it changed the dynamic dramatically. And I thought that was a phenomenal way to start this movie off. I'm not going to give up too much of the plot. I'll say what you pretty much can figure out from watching the trailers. That Barbie starts to have – Barbie's in Barbie Land. And Barbie Land is basically a land where Barbie and Barbies rule. And they are – you know, the Barbies are the president. Barbies are the Supreme Court. Barbies are the astronauts. Barbies are the doctors. Barbies are these. And the Kens are there and a few others. The Kens are there. But the Kens basically seem to be there only to make sure that – you know, they're there for Barbie. Whatever Barbie needs, the Kens are there for, which is kind of Barbie's world as it is right now. And Barbie starts having a little bit of a crisis. Without going into too many details, they basically have to go to the real world from the Barbie world. So Barbie, who's Margot Robbie, and Ken, who's Ryan Gosling, who's both of them are sensational in this movie, leave Barbie world and head to the real world. And I'm not giving up anything by saying I cannot applaud this movie enough for doing it so simply this way and pointing out something that I think everybody needs to understand is that there is obviously this massive culture shock for Barbie when she comes to the real world. But one of the things that becomes very crystal clear is that as they're in this world and we have this world where we're dealing with equality, we're dealing with women's rights, we're dealing with, you know, getting rid of misogyny, that you're really not. What you really have is half measures to make it seem like you're doing something to have a more equitable world here. But the reality is it's still a man's world and white men predominantly, and that's just that. And there's just this thing she goes from this world where the Barbies can be anything and they can do anything they want. And you know, to come into a world where men are like, we're for equal rights. We've got gender-neutral bathrooms. And you know, this goes back to something I have been saying kind of for years as a man, and I understand that I'm just on the outside of this looking at this. But I say to myself, you know, equality is not 18 cents less an hour. Equality is not – that's not equality. Equality is everyone gets paid the same amount. But if women bring this up, they're complaining, they're whining, they're bitching, they're moaning. They sometimes imply there's a that certain time of the month, oh, look at them, look at they're going like this. They dismiss you any way possible by pointing out the obvious. That it's not equity if you're paying people less. And once again, minority women are even lower on that scale. And until you fix that one major little hinge point, you can have as many gender-neutral bathrooms or token executives as you want. The reality is that it's not equity. And then they go the further point of pointing out that, as I talked about with the executives, that there really is an equality. The vast majority of corporations are run by men, predominantly white men, and that there might be one or two exceptions, but the vast majority of companies are there. To a point, I'm stunned Mattel actually allowed this movie to be done, because this movie is not – I mean, it's got fun and fluff for the kids. They'll enjoy it. They'll have a good time. But my God, is the message with this movie one of the strongest messages, is that equality is not just something you can say is done or you're dealing with half measures. Equality means equality. Fairness equals fairness. Those are things. And regardless if it's women the black population, the Hispanic population, the Native American population, the Asian population, LGBTQIA plus population. You can't say it's equality unless it truly is equality. And no paranoid conservative white people who are against this movie. And by the way, the only people who really should be against this movie are people who actively know that the system is rigged and the system is unfair to women and minorities in the LGBTQIA community. They know this and they want to keep it the way it is because they benefit from the unfairness. Simple. That's it. When you see right-wing trolls out there burning Barbie dolls, that's because he knows that basically this movie calls out the misogyny of this country and of the world to a point on a very with a sharp edge, you just, you know, surgical precision. It is unbelievable how good this movie does. It's good on a lot of levels. It highlights the inadequate job we've done with dealing with equity and the unfair standards that women have to exist on in this world. Undoubtedly, it does an amazing job of appealing to, and I didn't even think this was possible in this day and age, but if you watch Barbie, you could take your grandparents to Barbie. Baby boomers, Generation Xers, millennials, Generation Z, anyone who sees this movie will appreciate this movie. It appeals to everyone on all levels. And I didn't even think you could make a movie like that anymore. I didn't think you could make a movie like that where basically every generation goes into it and enjoys it for on its own level. That's phenomenal. How she pulled that little trick off, I'll never know. It's a phenomenal story about a daughter and a mother, the realities between the acting. There is such subtle acting there. America Ferrera is in there. The subtle acting that they have in those moments they have between the mother and the daughter, it is, you know, it's my daughters gave their mother a hug when they got out of that movie. They enjoyed that. But it even goes further, and this is one of the great parts about it. It even goes it's so about equity that it points out the toxic positions that men are forced into, that men are stuck in, that they shouldn't be there, the unhealthy trajectories of their lives that they're on, that they should get off of because not yet, and they only go along with it because, well, that's what's happened. That's what you do. And even they know this is not good. I'm dead serious. I know this movie was good and I knew it had more of a message, but I came out of that movie stunned at how good it was. And without a doubt, I mean, I got to think it's going to mop up at the Oscars. I've got to think it's going to. Because what Greta Gerwig did is take a movie that is about a doll and turn it into an insanely good requiem on the failures of American society in dealing with discrimination and in the lack of equity. To give you an idea how good this movie was. Now, I went and saw Endgame. All right. You know, Patrick, Avengers Endgame. Okay. One of the first times I was ever in a movie theater and I saw people in the audience go nuts was Rocky IV. When Rocky knocks, you know, all of a sudden clocks Drago really well. And there was a guy that was in front of me and says, "Yeah, get him!" Stands up and starts screaming. I'm like, wow, welcome to the 80s. Good. Were you in a theater that went kind of nuts when Endgame was – when that whole final like hour of Endgame went on?
I did not remember anybody going crazy.
I remember the audience. We had tickets on the opening weekend. I had to get them a month in advance. I remember we went and saw this, and the audible screams of pure delight at two points when Captain America pulled up Thor's hammer and started beating the living daylights out of Thanos with it was one. The second was the when he said Avengers Assemble, and you know the entire audience just went crazy, just went nuts. So I've seen this happen. There's a speech in this. I'm not going to say anything about it. I'm not going to. It is all-time great speeches. It's Charlie Chaplin in The Great Dictator. If you've not seen that speech, it's as good as it gets. This is up there. This speech is phenomenal about the injustices in the world that women face in our modern society. It is about 2 or 3 minutes long, and it is spectacular because it nails it perfectly. The character who delivers it gets done, and my wife, who never yelled at the Marvel movies, is a relatively timid individual, screams, "Oh, yeah!" I'm like, oh my God. Now, there comes a moment where I was like, hey, she's not yelling that because I'm a bad guy. I'm with the equal rights and equity. Hey, I'm not, you're all looking at me like I'm, no, I'm with, go team go, yay. I'm with you on this. Oh, it's good. Go see it. Seriously, go see it. Yes, it's a lot of Barbie and it's a lot of pink. But that movie, considering especially how millennials and Generation Z are, it resonates with them. This is one of those movies which is going to leave an impact on society. Jeff, hold on. I'll get your call in after the break. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. 82 cents on the dollar. That's what women make, is 18 cents less a dollar. And I've said this before when this has been brought up. It blows my mind that there are women on the Republican side who are saying, I deserve less money. And they do. That's what they say. And I don't know what to do with that. I don't, because I'm not a woman, so I don't want to. It sounds crazy. It sounds, at least from my perspective. But if you want to deal with equity, stop talking about these half measures and, you know, in programs and institutions, and you painted the lobby pink. Great. Fine. You're helping out with the, you know, Breast Cancer Awareness Foundation. Fantastic. That's wonderful. Fix the pay discrepancy and get women in top executive positions, including women of color. Ta-da. That will go a long way to fixing this problem. And like I said, Greta Gerwig did this so well because from the perspective of Barbie and Ken coming from the Barbie world into the real world, for them to see this world, it just showed you how little we've really done to deal with equity and how far we still need to go to deal with equity. Jeff is in Cambridge. He's been holding. Welcome on in, Jeff.
Yeah, I'm out walking the dog, and you mentioned Barbie, so I had to call. Quick things.
All right.
The opening scene was just utterly fantastic.
It was. That was very good.
There are pieces of that I forgot from the original 2001. Second, there's a comment from, like, the director. It's from a voice above saying that if you wanted to prove that point, you probably should have picked somebody other than Margot Robbie.
Yeah, it's Helen Mirren plays the narrator.
Yeah.
And by the way, let's make sure, Jeff, let's not give away any plot points here, okay?
But
and she says, and they're talking about, you know, I'm getting uglier and uglier, and Helen Mirren pops up and says, if you're going to try to make this point in this film, you probably shouldn't have cast Margot Robbie, who is actually quite stunningly pretty, and as she is.
Yeah. Okay, and then two more quick ones. America Ferrera and Rhea Perlman did fantastic.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Both of them. I mean, America Ferrera should be up for the Oscar for that. That was an amazing job she did with that role.
Yeah. I'm 67, never had a daughter, only had a son, and I just loved it. It was great.
All right. Hey, Jeff, thank you very much. You're kind of proving my point. I appreciate that. And this is nothing against Oppenheimer. Go see Oppenheimer. It's supposed to be quite good. I'm actually going to go probably see that in the next few weeks myself. But this is, you know, I'm listening to, it just so happens, the Smartless podcast has Greta Gerwig on it. And I've been listening to that. And they've talked a little bit about this. And, I mean, the long process of bringing this to the movie. and that, you know, it was in 2020 that they were first approached, and then the pandemic, and they were writing the thing, and initially she wasn't going to direct, and then when she decided to direct and how to kind of go with it, you know, it's a phenomenal film. God, there are some things in the second half where I was just cackling out loud laughing, not only because they were funny, and it has to do with Ken, and I'm not going to say any more, has to do with Ken, but because that cut to the core. Some of the stuff at the end of that just cut to the core. Quick side note. Do movie theater companies realize people want to go to the movies if there's a good movie out there? I mean, we had Top Gun last year. You had the Super Mario movie earlier this year. So I go, it's a Sunday at 11. I bought my tickets in advance. I have my little circle code ready to go to thing, and there's no one there. There's no one there. And there's a lot of people like sitting around like, where's the person for the tickets? I don't know, you know. And I finally said, well, we got tickets. Let's go grab our seats. I mean, if someone says, are these your tickets? I have the proof that we got the tickets. So we went and grabbed our seats. We came on out. The concession stand had probably about 100, or like it wasn't 100. It was probably 30, 35 people waiting in line. And I'm like, what is going on here? And I realized where the guy that was supposed to be taking tickets was. Everyone was working concessions because they clearly did not have enough people working. Now, I don't know if people called in sick, people didn't show up, what the case may be, but it seemed like they had quite a few people there. It just also seemed like nothing, you know, it was just overwhelmed. And the movie was really good. The experience at the movie wasn't. It was really bad. I mean, there were no lid cups. You had to go back. You know, it took us 25 minutes. Thank God there was about 40 minutes worth of previews for this movie. The minute it became popular, every movie coming out in the next, you know, 6 months put their preview in front of it. So that's why it is. So, but we got there. I was there 10 minutes before the movie was slated to start. It took 25 minutes to get through, to get just, you know, three popcorns and three sodas and get into the theater. Because they didn't have, like I said, straws or lids or anything like this. And I said, okay, I get it. You guys might have been caught off guard, but this was the second weekend of this film. I can't understand why this is so bad. And I've talked to other people too, and they said, yeah, they've gone to movies and it's like they're almost completely ill-prepared. And I don't know if it's the movie companies have cut staff because the pandemic, and I get it. It was tough. It's bad. But people are coming back to the movies. And the quickest way for you to basically turn them away is to give them a miserable experience. Because right now, I could go home, put a bag of microwave popcorn in the microwave, grab a soda from the sink, or the thing, where I go and brew it up myself. No, from the fridge, grab a soda, grab a bag of popcorn. In 4 minutes, I'm back downstairs sitting on the couch and I can watch a movie. I'd rather watch a movie in a theater. But if the experience is as bad as it was, I can tell you right now, what's going to kill movie theaters is not the movies, it's the theaters themselves. And that's a bit of a problem. And I'm concerned after watching that. I mean, this is one of the big mall ones, Southdale. It's supposed to be run pretty well, and it was a mess. And so just keep your expectations in line, or I don't know, maybe – I'm not going to tell you to sneak, you know, food and your beverages into the movie theater, but, you know, just prepare yourself. You might as well get the 30 minutes early, because if their staffing is this as bad as it is, it's going to take you that long just to get popcorn and soda. So, but at least we got, I guess, with reserved seats now, it's not nearly the big deal as it used to be. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Joe Harrington from R Streets, Minneapolis, joins us to talk about his essay in the Minnesota Reformer. When we do return, it's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. I can't shut off this stereo. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show. We've had to start addressing the fact that, two things. One, the history of how our major road system was built, which unfortunately was built upon racism usually, as they built these major highways across these, not only this city, but across the country. But as well, the fact that they have more problems than, you know, they generally cause more problems than they solve at times in regards to how that they're designed. We are currently in the position of reimagining some highways, particularly 94 from the stretch from 35E to the 35W. And the organization Our Streets Minneapolis had an essay written by Joe Harrington this morning in the Minnesota Reformer. I want to talk about that. Joe Harrington is a student in St. Paul studying urban geography and environmental policy. He is a GIS and data organizer for Our Streets Minneapolis. And Our Streets Minneapolis works to put people first by transforming transportation and infrastructure in the Twin Cities and at the state level. We do this by making our streets places where people can easily and comfortably walk, bike, roll, and use public transit. Joe, thank you very much. I appreciate the time today.
Hi there, Matt. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the time talking to you.
All right. So first of all, let's talk about your essay. When it comes to I-94, let's consider people, not cars. There's a lot of suggestions on what's going to happen here with Interstate 94, particularly, once again, from 35E to 35W. The Rondo neighborhood's been talked about a lot here. Why don't you just start off by talking a little bit about what's going on right now and then kind of get into what Our Streets Minneapolis wants to do.
Yeah, absolutely. So starting off with this Rethinking I-94 project, and the real idea of the project started back in 2016 when then MnDOT Commissioner Charlie Zelli initiated the project. And I-94 between Minneapolis and St. Paul, like many other roadways in the U.S., is reaching the end of its useful life. The infrastructure has been there for over 60 years, and we have a once-in-a-generation opportunity to kind of reevaluate and reimagine what we want this corridor to be for the next 100 years or so. And, you know, where we're at right now in that process, Our Streets Minneapolis has worked really hard to center community in this conversation, because so often in these past highway and other urban planning decisions, community voices were ignored, and we want to center them in the conversation here. As you mentioned earlier, systemic racism behind highway planning and placement has led to these historic and ongoing harms that disproportionately fall on communities of color along these corridors. And if we continue to, you know, now that we're reevaluating the highway, if we continue to ignore these harms, we're, you know, guilty of being complicit in perpetuating them for future generations to come. And because transportation is such an intersectional issue, it's important to environmental justice, it's important to community health, communities' economies, people's mobility, we have to really think carefully before we spend a huge amount of money on a mega project. So I-94, Rethinking I-94, and what the Twin Cities Boulevard vision has become is a community-driven vision to reimagine the corridor, do a highway-to-boulevard conversion, and has really been a community vision. You know, we've knocked over 30,000 doors along the corridor. 70% of those people who responded are in favor for studying a highway to boulevard conversion that centers, you know, people and places that are, you know, traditionally marginalized, but providing them with access to transportation infrastructure that actually works for them. So having diverse options for transit, biking, rolling, walking, reconnecting street grids, and allowing for some redevelopment for community business and affordable housing. That's kind of the project from 90,000 feet, you know.
Well, and very well said, by the way. Let's expand a little bit about this interstate to boulevard idea, just to make sure everyone understands what we're talking about here. It sounds basically like you want to fill in the gap that is 94, especially particularly through the Midway, and on top of, you know, at street level, where the street level is now, not the interstate level, but the street level. You know, flush that out and turn it into a boulevard. Is it? You know, are we thinking something like Summit Avenue, or what kind of boulevard are we kind of talking about here?
Yeah, so we're promoting an idea that's actually been studied in other parts of the U.S. Cities like Syracuse, Rochester, Duluth, even here in Minnesota, are at various different points of scoping, evaluating, studying, or implementing a similar project. But what we're advocating for is a multimodal boulevard. So what that means is that, you know, the trench that I-94. You know, has through all of the communities along the corridor. So that's from, you know, Merriam Park, Frogtown, Cedar Riverside, Seward, Hamlin Midway, Rondo, others. All of these communities have been subjected to these harms, as we just said. And we have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to both, you know, reconnect the street grid, reimagine the infrastructure there so you know, people not only have better access to goods and services, but they can bike through that area safely. They can walk and roll through that area safely. They have access to really good, high-quality transit. So what that means in the context of a highway to boulevard conversion is that there would still be some through traffic lanes, but there would also be dedicated space for public transit, for biking, for walking, for green space. And then the remaining land that the highway and the highway trench and the frontage roads currently occupy could be redeveloped into housing and community businesses and green space. So all of these things are definitely something that our community voices that we've been centering in our conversation have been asking for. And it's something that we have been, you know, pushing MnDOT to both study, evaluate, and eventually ultimately implement. But all of these cities across Minnesota, across the U.S., went over major surgery in the 1960s when highways were built. Mm-hmm. And it is true that these areas didn't have the highways prior to that, and they had vibrant communities, and they were targeted for destruction oftentimes because of its high, you know, percentage communities of color. So this is something that's, you know, maybe seen as radical to some, but we're kind of in a state, both with these systemic harms in our city and around the country, these, you know, racist planning policies, these environmental justice issues, these transportation issues, the climate crisis. It's very intersectional. So the highway to boulevard conversion is the best way to address those corridor-wide for the 100,000 people who live along the corridor.
So I'm going to, and just make sure we understand this, this would change. This boulevard would run from, it looks like Marion Street in St. Paul. So just to the west of Rice Street. Marion Street through Midway, past 280, across the river, over to basically 55 where it hits 35W. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. That's the project corridor as MnDOT has defined it for the Rethinking I-94 project. So that's where we have the opportunity to make, you know, the biggest impact as far as, you know, repairing these systemic harms and also protecting our climate and environment as well. So it's the communities along that entire corridor who are affected.
I do like the images, and I'll encourage you to go read the story, the essay over it at MnPost, because it at least gives you an idea of what we're looking at here and just what you've got here. And it talks about, and right now, let's talk about what's there right now. You've got, what is it, 3 to 4 lanes. I think at some points it's 5 lanes on each side of 94 east-west, correct?
That's correct. Yeah. So currently, you know, there are a couple of options. They presented 10 different options for rethinking I-94, and these are project alternatives that they're going to continue to evaluate over the next year or so during a scoping period. So what this is going to look like, there were, you know, options ranging from, you know, highway to boulevard conversion. Like, there were two options that were kind of promoting that vision, and that's a huge win for the Twin Cities boulevard concept, but we don't feel that it goes far enough to actually center community voices and community vision to make sure that their perspectives and their desires for the infrastructure in their communities are heard. We're continuing to advocate for that work. But there were other options that range from a no build, so kind of leaving the highway in the state that it's currently in, a changing the frontage roads, so there'd basically be some local traffic lanes and some smaller through traffic lanes, all the way up to highway expansion, which would add additional lanes for, they call it a managed lane, for both east and westbound for additional traffic. That would be your HOV lane or a dedicated transit lane, but also continuing to have the same number of other travel lanes as well. So it would be a highway expansion that, according to MnDOT themselves, could bring up to 25% more traffic through the corridor.
What, you know, is there a reason why? Because one of the ones that got a lot of traction and people were talking about was a land bridge in the Rondo neighborhood particularly, but I don't see why you probably couldn't do this across, especially Cedar Riverside, over on the Minneapolis side. Is there a reason why the idea of a land bridge with being able to develop, you know, walkways, pedestrian walkways, bike lanes, maybe even transit lanes on a on top of these highways? Is there a reason why that your organization doesn't like that idea?
Well, we believe, and this is actually something that's come up a lot in our work in communities, too, and this has been centered in all of the communities along the corridor, especially, you know, Cedar Riverside, Seward, Frogtown, Hamlin Midway, Merriam Park, other areas that, you know, are not going to be benefited by a land bridge. So the land bridge has a very narrow, narrow benefits, and it actually would only, you know, there's only a small percentage of the 100,000 people who live along the corridor that would actually be affected by that project. In any case, with a land bridge, it basically leaves MnDOT to build, rebuild, or expand the highway however they see fit without solving the harms that disproportionately fall on communities of color living in other places along the corridor, mm-hmm. from Minneapolis to St. Paul. And a land bridge, you know, it just doesn't go far enough. So we're hoping to see a vision that really centers all communities along the corridor, and making sure that both these, you know, systemic racist harms and environmental harms, all of which that are both historic and ongoing, are addressed in the project.
All right, so I'm going to bring up, I was in a past life a traffic reporter. I'm going to bring up the most obvious thing that when I see this project, I'm like, okay, wait a second here. I-94 is the major east-west road that carries 160, according to CARE 11, 160,000 cars per day. That is a fairly substantial amount of traffic. What your plan doesn't create, and I want to be very clear, and this is, it's just, you're going to take 94 and convert it to a boulevard. It doesn't make another major highway here. It basically has two lanes of traffic, but it's at intersections with traffic lights as it's boulevarded through. It doesn't have this. What has your study shown about the impact of taking a major highway that does have a substantial amount of traffic and removing it? Where would all that traffic go?
Yeah, that's certainly a very good question, and it's a concern that's cited by many at MnDOT, and it's something that people in the community ask about as well. And while it is a valid concern, just from the community standpoint, it's important to remember that a lot of communities along the corridor who bear the disproportionate burdens that the freeway infrastructure and land use and environmental issues, you know, kind of cause, a lot of them actually don't have access to a car. So we're trying to promote a vision that, you know, one, prioritizes the communities and helps them, you know, repair these historic harms, but two, makes an infrastructure that's also available for them to use. And talking about traffic in this conversation, it's very important to think about two concepts called induced demand and traffic evaporation. And these two concepts are related. They're the opposite. So induced demand is a principle that states as you widen a highway, the increased lanes make it more appealing to drive. And that could also be true as if we keep the number of lanes the same in this case. The increased traffic levels and the congestion in some cases are actually just as bad, if not worse, prior to highway expansion. You can look at the famous example in Houston. It's North America's biggest freeway, the Katy Freeway.
Yeah.
It's up to 26 lanes today. And it's kind of been falling trapped to the, you know, it's actually, I guess, kind of a common problem in places around the U.S., the unstoppable appeal of highway expansion, as Bloomberg puts it. But they did a great study on that, and it shows that even, you know, after highway expansion, it only made congestion worse just 3 years later. So beyond Houston, this principle has been studied in other places, and that piece, Why Widening Highways Doesn't Bring Traffic Relief by Bloomberg, mm-hmm. does a great job explaining it, as well as resources on our website. But the flip side is also true. So induced demand is more lanes, more traffic. But traffic evaporation is the opposite. So less lanes leads to less traffic in general terms. So as lanes are reduced, driving becomes less appealing. Commuters choose other options such as biking, walking, riding high-quality transit. And in some cases, trips are removed altogether by changes in land use. So if we redevelop areas along the highway land that's along the corridor there, if you had more housing, more access to goods and services, it would actually change people's could potentially change people's choices as where they live and how they locate themselves near their job or near resources that they need to access in the community. And COVID, too, you know, remote work has changed a lot of these things, and MnDOT hasn't really accounted for that in their modeling, you know, work from home. So there's also less trips in general on the highway.
Joe, I'm not going to disagree with you. Los Angeles is another city where they keep building lanes and it doesn't get any better. The reality is this is 94. This is the major east-west road. So you're going to have to divert a lot of traffic that's just cutting through the city, which means Oakdale, North St. Paul, Badness Heights, Little Canada, Roseville, Shoreview, New Brighton, they're going to pick up a heck of a lot more traffic. Or if it goes up 35W, Little Canada up onto 694. That traffic's going to be there. The reality as well is, my guess is going to be, is that with this design that you're putting forward, that just having looked at when we had traffic lights on 12, we had traffic lights on 169. Now, those weren't boulevards, but there were traffic lights there. What you end up doing is you're going to create a massive amount of traffic there. We're reducing the lanes from 3 to 5 lanes down to 2 lanes. So you're going to have a massive amount of traffic there, especially morning, afternoon drive. University, Summit, any road that goes east-west in St. Paul as well is going to pick up an insane amount of traffic. I love it if we could be like Europe. I lived in Europe for 3 years. I would love it if we could be like that. That's just not something that's going to be attainable quickly. And so when you look at this, I mean, that's a big problem. I mean, that's a lot of vehicles, and it almost feels like what you're saying is, well, for the St. Paul people, we're going to make their life, we're going to try to make their lives better, whether or not there'll be more traffic. But for anyone on the 694 loop or 35E to 694 loop, we're going to make your lives a little worse because there's going to be a lot more traffic there. And that's, you know, that's just the way it is. I mean, there's just a lot of vehicles that just take 94 right through the city.
Well, I would just like to say, I guess, starting on the idea of quickness, you know, none of these changes are going to be quick. The project is actually probably not even, you know, 10 years out from construction. It's going to take a long time to scope, do environmental impact assessments, and then actually narrow down which project alternative will actually take place. And what we're talking about here, repairing systemic harms that have been happening for hundreds of years in the U.S. and even earlier elsewhere, is also not going to be a quick fix. So, you know, I understand that it seems, again, radical for, you know, us to kind of push for this type of thing, but one, you know, Minnesota and the Twin Cities really has to have and is having a reckoning around racial and environmental justice in the wake of the George Floyd murders and the events of the last couple of years. So we really need to think boldly and act boldly and plan boldly going forward to, you know, both respect, repair, and protect communities throughout the Twin Cities. It's not necessarily, maybe the commuting time is, you know, worsened for suburban commuters in some cases. We don't really know fully yet because this hasn't been studied to the full, you know, extent that MnDOT, we're pushing MnDOT to do an in-depth feasibility study. But it's not necessarily the idea of making it worse, because we're all better in the Twin Cities if our communities are protected from these disproportionate harms that benefit, you know, mostly commuters and fall disproportionately on these urban communities along urban highways. So I think we're all better when we do better in this case. And again, it's not going to be a quick fix. This is going to be a change that happens over a long period of time. Land use has to change. Higher investment in public transit has to change. But I do think, again, you know, this moment of racial reckoning here, as well as the climate crisis, all summer we've been dealing with wildfire smoke from Canada. And if these two factors are not really the impetus for thinking boldly and acting boldly and trying to change the way we plan and design and imagine our cities, then I'm not sure what will.
I agree with what a lot you're trying to do here, but I think we do need to ask the question of, okay, what do we do with the 160,000 vehicles? Because a boulevard's not going to be able to handle that. And so, and as you say, it creates more locality. I live in Hopkins, and I go to St. Paul all the time. Go to the Science Museum, go to the XL Energy Center, go to the theater and stuff over there. If it's one of those things where now all of a sudden I'm going to add 30 minutes to my commute to get over there because we shut down one of the major roads and it's constantly busy, I don't know if that's – I think that – I agree with a lot of what you're trying to do here, but I think that there has to be a practicality element of it. And it's easy – you're right. Climate change is bad. The racial injustice that created these highways is god-awful. Highway 55, I was just reading about that one today. But I think the damage to a point at one point has been done, and we have this a lot of traffic here, and just sort of saying it will go somewhere else. I think we have to have a better plan for that. It might be, I think it'd be a wash if you want to know the truth, if you think just about the distance on 94 through St. Paul, through Minneapolis, up to 694. If you routed it around on just 694 and kind of remove that, I think that's kind of a wash. It's not adding too much time, gas, or anything like that. But you're going to have to put a major investment into the expansion of that highway to carry all those extra trucks that are no longer going through the Midway area. And so I think that there's just that, if that's the only thing here, I agree with a lot of what you're saying. I think there has to be an application of practicality here that you can't just sort of say, well, we hope it's okay. It's got to be, where does all those trucks go, or where all those vehicles go?
Yeah, I think we want to do more than hope it will be okay. And we want to have an actual viable study conducted by MnDOT or other organizations that can actually evaluate this, because, you know, we want to actually have a realistic idea using models that both, you know, encompass traffic evaporation and induced demand, but also talk about land use in a way that, you know, could actually model potentially what the land use changes would actually do towards the number of trips through that area, as we talked about traffic evaporation. But I just want to reiterate, you know, the damage has, you know, you mentioned that the damage has been done, but the damage is actually ongoing and will continue to harm generations into the future. You know, I'm in my 20s now. The next time that we reevaluate this corridor will probably be 80 to 100 years from now. And if we continue to perpetuate these harms and think about, you know, the, in terms of only using traffic as a metric, then we're going to continue to do the same urban planning and traffic and highway mistakes that planners have made in the past. Mm-hmm. And those were intentional then, and we just want to make sure we're not complicit in that today. But we're advocating for, you know, eventually to enact this proposal. But in the meantime, we have to study it. And we're pushing MnDOT to actually do a study in good faith that represents the community's voices and enacts that vision. But it has to be studied, and we're not, you know, we're not saying the traffic isn't a consideration because it does weigh in a lot of people's minds. But in general, in the context of this climate crisis, in the context of repairing these harms on local communities, we really do have to think boldly. And I think that, you know, letting traffic be the only stopper of that is not necessarily the right way to move forward, because we do have other roads through the communities. And obviously, you know, we don't want to divert traffic elsewhere in the Twin Cities, but the harms that are on these disproportionately marginalized communities along the corridor have really high populations. Yeah. They've been historically harmed there. And we want to make sure to center them in this conversation as we reevaluate the corridor.
Joe Harrington from Our Streets Minneapolis. Joe, I appreciate the time. I'll post the article up a little bit later on. And thank you very much. I appreciate your time today, okay?
Thank you. I appreciate your time. And I'd encourage everyone to fill out the MnDOT survey on this project to make their perspectives heard.
952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. Okay, I'm not going to disagree that we do need to address the racial wrongs here. We also have to address the fact that these communities are not being served by having a huge gaping highway in the middle of them, cutting it off across, and one crosswalk every, you know, three blocks is not cutting it. Here's just the, you know, and I'm going to just say this. Here's the problems I can already see are going to come up if you just boulevard out 94. One, industry is going to have to leave the area. If you're on, say, the southern side of 280 and you get to 280, that via 94, and now all of a sudden you have to go all the way around the metro, you're going to lose money on gas. And so, and that's kind of counterproductive to what you're trying to do. So they're going to have to move out, which is going to mean jobs are leaving, industry, businesses are going to leave. Every street east-west will be packed trying to get east and west, especially during morning and afternoon rush. Every east-west street, far worse. There will be much more on the residential areas. Other communities will have to bear the brunt of this, so just sort of saying it's time their turn to pick it up. I don't know if that's good. It's dramatically going to cut the city in half, and I think a lot of businesses would have impact. I'll talk a little bit more about this when we come back. Hour two up next. Hour number two of the show. Matt Patrick here. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. A little more on Joe Harrington, that interview I just did at Our Streets Minneapolis, which will be up on the SoundCloud here before too long, out there streaming. A few things from just when I was finishing up. First of all, I would love to have a transportation system like Europe. My God, the Germans, their transportation system was amazing. You didn't need a car. Not only did you not need a car in major metro areas, you could live in some place like Ely and not have a car. Not have to have a car. It was phenomenal. It was phenomenal. Two things. One, we just, in the United States, did not design our cities that way. And two, we allowed the rubber and gas and automobile industry to buy up all the streetcar lines that we had, shut them down, and force people into cars. And then came the interstate system. And I mean, Eisenhower's interstate system actually had, he was looking at it as more military applications. But the reality is it did undeniably went right into the more racist areas. They weren't going to go tear up Edina for an interstate. They weren't going to go tear up Bloomington at that point for an interstate. They weren't going to go tear up wealthier parts of Minneapolis. Nope, they just weren't. And it was just a horrible racial injustice that they did. Wanting to fix all this is not a bad idea. Minneapolis already has an exceptional amount of bike trails. we have this great fight. We're trying to build light rail lines, but, you know, and it doesn't help when the Met Council and the contractor are doing a freaking incompetent job of building the Southwest light rail line. But, you get people who are like, I don't want light rail, which is far more energy efficient than anything like that. And then, you know, they just want more cars and want more lanes. And notice that even if that was their argument, they don't give you money for more cars and more lanes. They just basically want, you know, just somehow to snap your fingers. Yeah, there's a lot here. But I got to tell you, I look at shutting down I-94. I want you to think about this for a second. Shutting down 94 from Marion Street to 35W, all the way through the Midway, across the river, past 280, past Cedar Riverside, right up to Highway 55, and shutting that down and turning it into a boulevard. You got to have a major east-west road. And I and Joe was very clear that he wanted MnDOT to do research on this. They want them to do some research. You're going to have a solution for the traffic, because going from three to five lanes down to two lanes is going to make that a nightmare. So you either have to route it up through these other communities, and it kind of negates your argument to say we need to make safer communities, but what we'll do is we'll trade off St. Paul for Oakdale and North St. Paul and Falcon Heights and Vadnais Heights. We'll allow them to pick up the brunt of it. Or if you wouldn't go south, because that wouldn't make any sense. You have to kind of go to the north side. So you either have to send the traffic up 694 around the metro as it is, or you have to send it up 35E, which is going to dramatically affect those communities. And you're going to need to improve those two, whatever way you do, you're going to have to improve those communities, which is going to cost, you know, billions of dollars, because you're going to have to rebuild them in some areas. I mean, Lake Elmo on 694 is like two lanes in a lot of that stretch. You're going to need to have major traffic, because that's the major east-west road through the city. Because so you got that, and I think that you can't just sort of say, well, we need to do this. We need to stop climate change, but that's not going to stop climate change per se. It just is going to create more climate change, you know, the same climate change just in different areas. Does it make it nicer for the people that are in that area? Somewhat. I mean, it's going to make it a lot less convenient. Now, and Patrick, you had brought up something during the break there, and I want to make sure I give you credit for this, because this is kind of a mentality. There's an element to this mentality which is, I think, focused on kind of an antiquated model. And you were thinking about this in regards to when you buy a place or rent a place, what your real use is in that area, right?
Yes, exactly.
And that's basically that the idea is that people just are in the area that they're in?
Yeah, that's kind of the point I was making. And I don't think this is what the intent is, but just some of the vibe I was getting from, you know, you rip out a freeway, okay, well, you kind of go to some alternatives, but there are issues with the alternatives. And I kind of got, and I know you commented that you kind of got this impression from some of what the interview said was, if you live in a place, you're supposed to stay in the place, and it's supposed to be inconvenient to go far from that place.
And that's kind of the mentality, is that we're not making this convenient for you to go to Minneapolis or go to, if you're in the Midway, necessarily to downtown St. Paul. But in theory, your grocery, you just basically, you don't need to go anywhere. You can basically, you know, just, you know, your grocery stores, your restaurants, your job, all that will be within walking distance of your house, and there you go. A very small town mentality towards a major city, that just doesn't work. And as a matter of fact, I have been in foreign countries, in London, Paris, I have been in Frankfurt, Berlin, I have been in Munich, Rome. People, even when I was there, and this was 30 years ago, people didn't just stick around in their certain neighborhoods. Sure, they might have come back to their neighborhood, might have done some grocery shopping or grabbed a meal in their neighborhood, but most people work other places. And that's not going to change. And as a matter of fact, I think that the idea of shutting down 94 and turning it into a boulevard, you're immediately going to kiss a lot of jobs goodbye. And not just industrial or, you know, construction or, you know, major industry. But there's a lot of restaurants that need to draw in people from the rest of the metro more than their, say, 10 square block radius. That you need to have. I mean, if I'm going to have a pizza place, I want people to come here. And I want it to be as easy as it possibly can be. And you're not going to have easy. I mean, if you turn 94 into a boulevard, I mean, my God, can you imagine what the traffic would be on the bridges going across the river into Minneapolis or going back over into St. Paul on any given day? Holy cow. And don't get me wrong, I get it. Once again, pedestrian friendly, bikes and stuff like this. But if I'm driving a semi truck from Wisconsin, I got to go to North Dakota. When I get to Minneapolis, I'm not putting a freaking bike on the front of the truck and biking through the city. You still have to be able to drive the traffic through. And I just don't know if that's a viable option. I commend them. I think it's an ideal. It's pie in the sky. But I also kind of get the impression that if anyone comes back and says, well, we really can't do this, we have to have some level of interstate highway on 94, you're setting yourself up to where that's not going to be acceptable. And I just don't know. I was kind of hoping they had a solution that, oh, well, we're going to call for a major investment into these other roads. They didn't necessarily. I can add really quick, guarantee the XL Energy Center, the Children's Museum, the Science Museum, you know, all the Minnesota History Museum. I got to believe none of them want create a situation where it's an extra half an hour, 45 minutes to get over to St. Paul for anyone from the Minneapolis side so that people just stop going over there.
Yeah. And the other thing that I was thinking about in regards to this, what we were talking about a moment ago, whether we like to admit it or not, you know, you need to get trucks to the businesses on Snelling and on Selby and on University Avenue. Those, I think a lot of people, it's kind of out of sight, out of mind, that because most of the time you don't see a truck delivering goods to a business, you know, out on in your daily life. But, you know, unfortunately, I and like you and I have been saying, this is not meant to dismiss any of the concerns that are being
their
made.
Their concerns are very valid.
Absolutely.
Indeed.
But those businesses that you want to prioritize in your neighborhoods along this corridor need a way to get trucks with goods to their businesses.
Someone brought up the part, they said one of the reasons why the land bridges over Rondo particularly are not a good idea is because the you would have to move hazmat material over there. Now, that I think you can make an argument probably shouldn't be going through the city anyway. Routing around on the outer loop would probably be the best way to do that anyway. I don't know. I think this is such a grandiose option. And sure, I have zero doubt that people whose houses are worth $70,000 because they are on Interstate 94 looking out and having a Summit Avenue type of boulevard in front of their house and their properties shoot up 8-9 times in value, yeah, I guarantee you they're probably like, this is a great idea. But I think you have to figure – you got to still figure out a way to have traffic. You have to have it's 160,000 vehicles per day. It's 160,000 vehicles per day on 94 between the two towns. You're going to have to put those vehicles somewhere. And you can't, I mean, this is just basic math. You can't go from 4-lane highways down to 2-lane highways and think it's going to be faster drive. You can't. Bike lanes, absolutely. Commuter friendly, absolutely. More mass transit options, absolutely. But I just don't know how you're going to. I just don't know how you're going to have a functioning city in this day. And granted, once again, Matt, you don't understand. Matt, you just don't get it. Matt, we should be more like this. Yeah, I agree with that. But that's not going to happen like that. You're just not going to be able to snap your fingers and, you know, change. It's, you know, if you want to do this, and I'm going to be conservative here. If you want to do this, this is a 100-year plan, and I am dead serious. It's already been 60 years. We've seen that the interstate system doesn't really work. You want to do this, you need to build up efficient, clean mass transit. You need to slowly encourage the heavy traffic to go around the area. You're going to have to improve all the bridges going into Minneapolis. You're going to have to improve all the highways going into Minneapolis. You're going to have to, you know, 280 is going to be a wash. I mean, you're going to lose so many businesses off of 280. That Industrial Boulevard, I mean, and that's the reason why it's appealing is because it's easy access to 94. I mean, if you're on the southern side, you're on the University or Como side of 280, right? How much more gas are you going to have to spend just to get your vehicles up all the way to 36? That's your closest route. 36 over to 35E and then 35E down and around. It's going to be an extra 2 gallons, 3 gallons of gas just on that one little loop. Your costs are going to skyrocket. All those businesses are going to go. And, you know, granted, I mean, you say to yourself, well, okay, those are jobs. Well, kind of your concept here seems to be, well, people from the suburbs shouldn't be coming and working those jobs anyway. So, fine, you got rid of those, but then where are the people are going to work? I commend the idea. I think in a utopian world, sounds great. But you got to have a better answer to what do you do with 160,000 cars per day? Other than saying, you know, well, we got to make up for the racial injustice. Undoubtedly, 100%. What are you doing with 160,000 cars per day? We got to start pushing green energy. Undoubtedly, agree wholeheartedly. What are you doing with 160,000 cars per day? We got to make more pedestrian-friendly communities. Absolutely, 100% agree. What are you doing with 160,000 cars per day? You got to have a better answer for that because that's everything right there. Fred is in Minneapolis wanting to chime in on this. Welcome on in, Fred.
Yeah, one environmental issue involved with all this goes well beyond the Twin Cities. There is a major intermodal terminal just west of Snelling Avenue, north of 94, just south of the State Fair. And if the trucks cannot get to that terminal so those boxes can be loaded on a train or taken off a train and loaded on a truck, that means the shippers are going to say, to heck with the railroad, we're just going to have you send it all the way on the truck. And now you've got trucks running all over the country that don't need to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then also, once again, you create kind of a bit of a dead zone in that area, the Energy Park Drive area, where you know you kind of create a dead zone because no business will want to be out there. And there's a lot of businesses that are out there.
Not to mention the fact that the very people in the communities we're trying to atone with need those jobs to be readily in their immediate area.
Exactly. Now, and that,
you know,
and
if you live in Rondo or what's left of it, and you don't have a car, that your job moving out to the suburb is not a good thing.
No, exactly. And no, and thanks, Fred. That's a spot on point. Those industrial jobs that are going to leave because of that, those are the ones where you're going to get the better pay. And okay, I get it. You know, the idea is okay, Matt. Well, we just rezone it. We tear down all the industry. We build a whole bunch of buildings. God, how long is that going to take? And still, where all those people work? I guess maybe they work on building the buildings, but once the buildings are built, what do? I don't know. I like I said, I can't agree more with a lot of what they're saying. But once again, there is a very large question. What are you doing with the 160,000 cars that travel 94 through Minneapolis, St. Paul each day? What are you doing with them? Because I can tell you right now, as a resident of the city, it's one thing to ship some guy that's driving, you know, a load of cargo from Madison up to Fargo up around the 694 loop. It's another thing for saying, hey, you in St. Louis Park, you want to get over to St. Paul? Well, you better add 40 minutes to your drive because you're either going to need an extra 40 minutes just to get through the traffic nightmare that's the boulevard that used to be Interstate 94, or you're going to have to shoot all the way to the south, deal with the additional traffic that's no longer on 94, on 694 and 494, and then hopefully cut up and get and do that. Guess what's going to happen? People are not going to go across town. And maybe you're applauding that? That's That's economic suicide, I frankly think. I mean, people from St. Paul won't go to Minneapolis. People from Minneapolis won't go to St. Paul. That's, yeah. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show. Boom. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Interesting conversation there. Once again, a lot of what they say I like. What are you doing with 160,000 cars per day? And you can't necessarily just make Minneapolis and St. Paul two separate entire entities. So you're going to have to, those are things. Like I said, they want a study. I think you should do the study. But I, just be prepared if the study comes back and says, oh, hell no, we can't do that. You can't just grab your toys and run home and complain about how they never gave it a chance. 952-946-6205. As Patrick mentioned at the beginning of the show, Pee Wee Herman has passed away. Paul Reubens, the actor and comedian whose character Pee Wee Herman became a cultural phenomenon through films and TV shows, has died. He was 70 years old. Reubens died Sunday night after a six-year struggle with cancer that he did not make public, his publicist said in a statement. Please accept my apology for not going public with what I've been facing for the last 6 years, Reubens said in a statement released on Monday after the announcement of his death. I have always felt a huge amount of love and respect for my friends, fans, and supporters. They have loved you. I have loved you all so much, and I enjoyed making art for you. The character with his too tight gray suit, white chunky loafers, and red bow ties was best known for the film Pee-wee's Big Adventure, a fantastic film, by the way, an absolutely fantastic film. It's the television show Pee-wee's Playhouse. The Pee-wee character would become a cultural constant for much of the 1980s though an indecent exposure arrest in 1991 would send him into entertainment exile for many years. Reubens created Pee-wee Herman when he was part of the Los Angeles improv group, the Groundlings, in the 1970s. The live Pee-wee Herman show debuted at a Los Angeles theater in 1981 and was a success with both kids during matinees and adults at the midnight shows. The show closely resembled the format of a Saturday morning TV Pee-wee's Playhouse that would follow years later, with Herman living in a wild and wacky home with a series of stock characters visiting, including one, Captain Carl, played by late Saturday Night Live host Phil Hartman. In the plot, Pee-wee secretly wishes to fly. HBO would air the show as a special. Pee-wee got his wish to fly, as Steve Martin tweeted after his death. Thanks, Paul Reubens, for the brilliant off-the-wall comedy. Reubens took to Pee-wee to the big screen in 1985's Pee-wee's Big Adventure. I remember that was – we were all excited to go see that. That was huge. As a matter of fact, if I can say, Pee-wee's Playhouse was one of the first shows that kind of drove people – they went out of their way to find that. And nowadays it happens all the time with all the streaming services. You'll hear something about Umbrella Academy or something like that, and people are all going to go find that one. That was one of the first times that happened. That would be especially that people are like, where is HBO? Okay. The film in which Pee-wee Cherish's bike was stolen, he said it was loosely based on the Italian neorealistic classic, The Bicycle Thief. The film, directed by Tim Burton and co-written by Phil Hartman on Saturday Night Live, sent Pee-wee on a nationwide escapade. The movie was a success, grossing up to $40 million, and continued to spawn a cult following for his All About Lindsay. I'm thinking about that great scene when he's at the Alamo. The stars are big and bright. Deep in the heart, he holds the phone up and everyone sings. That is a great scene. The sequel followed 3 years later with the less well-received Big Top Pee-wee, in which Pee-wee seeks to join the circus. Reubens' character wouldn't get another movie starring role until 2016's Pee-wee's Big Holiday for Netflix. Judge Apatow produced Pee-wee's big screen revival. His television series, Pee-wee's Playhouse, ran for 5 seasons, earned 22 Emmys, and attracted not only children but adults to Saturday morning TV. It was great. If I can say, in a very different kind of light, a bit of a precursor for MST3K. And the reason why I say that is because MST3K, I knew a lot of kids who loved that show, especially the Godzilla ones, and they'd show the Godzilla. Because back then, I don't think you could – in the late 80s, most of the TV channels that were airing Godzilla stopped doing so. So they got them, and of course, it was Crow and Tom Servo were fun. They were robots. The kids loved them. But I knew as just as many adults that watched it. The show that was like that beforehand was Pee-wee's Playhouse. And, it was really remarkable. And an iconic character. He, of course, also had a few other roles out there, including Buffy the Vampire Slayer, correct?
Yes, he was also a cameo. He was the Penguin's father in Batman Returns.
That's right, he was. And by the way, grossly underrated above all the Batman films. Batman Returns was a phenomenal one, and yeah, he did. He and his wife chucked DeVito's penguin into the river and got rid of him. Yeah, that was kind of dark, just a smidge dark there. But yeah, it did a lot of voice work as well. And yeah, just, very sad loss. And like I said, mostly voice work, but he did a few other roles too, which he was well known for and well loved for. He was also in, what was that superhero one where with, Janine Garofalo and, Mystery Men. He was also in Mystery Men. Remember that?
I don't think I ever saw that show, unfortunately.
Yeah, it wasn't great. It wasn't great. I mean, William H. Macy was very good in that, but everything pretty much no. And you know, even Ben Stiller wasn't really. It wasn't great. Anyway, there you go.
If I can add one thing, I was thinking about, you know, obviously there have been a lot of actors who have become associated with a character. But it was for Pee-wee, I'm kind of thinking about Paul Reubens. That's on another level. Like, could I ever envision someone else ever trying to play Pee-wee Herman? And the answer is absolutely no way ever.
I will say this. When Jim Carrey did Andy Kaufman in the biopic, I mean, they're going to eventually do probably a biopic of him down the road. They'll find someone. You know, maybe like, you know. Who is the kid that was, I can't remember it. I'll tell you what, let me take a break. I'll find the kid. There's a kid out there right now that if he wanted to play him, I bet he could pull it off. Because he looks exactly like him to a point. I'll tell you who it is in a second. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show. The person who could do Pee-wee Herman in the biopic easy is Cody Smit-McPhee. If you did not see Power of the Dog, that was the Western with Benedict Cumberbatch and Kristen Dunst. He played her son in that, and he looks a lot like him. And he's a good enough actor that he probably could pull it off. But no one's going to replace him. You couldn't do that. It's all you can do is a biopic of the guy. So, but you know, that would be if anyone was going to be able to pull that off, it'd probably be him. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. So let me update you on the story that's been breaking throughout the day. This is the latest update of about 30 minutes ago. A state trooper shot and killed a black motorist early Monday morning, teen traffic stop on I-94 in North Minneapolis, prompting the state's largest law enforcement agency to vow the expeditious release of body cam footage. Although authorities have not named the motorist, family members identify the driver as 33-year-old Ricky Cobb II of Spring Lake Park. On Monday afternoon, the State Patrol issued a statement outlining their version of events that led to the fatal shooting on westbound 94 near 42nd Avenue North. According to the statement, state troopers spotted a Ford Fusion with no taillights traveling north near Lowry Avenue just after 1:50 a.m. and pulled the driver over. During the stop, troopers learned that the motorist was wanted by law enforcement in Ramsey County in connection with a felony-level violation. The state does not reveal what that violation was. As the troopers worked to detain the driver refused to exit the vehicle, and the statement continued, troopers were attempting to remove the driver of the vehicle when the driver drove away. At some point, a trooper fired upon the motorist, the statement said. Three troopers since have been placed on standard administrative leaves. Those law enforcement officers have not been named. It's not immediately clear how many troopers fired their weapons or what exactly triggered the use of deadly force. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension responded to the scene to investigate what the State Patrol originally dubbed as use of force incident. Cobb was wanted for questioning in relation to an alleged violation of standing domestic order for protection. The Ramsey County Sheriff's Office on Friday issued a 72-hour request for agencies to pick up and hold Cobb related to a felony-level violation, according to a department spokesperson. The order, which grants law enforcement probable cause to detain an individual, would have expired later on Monday morning. Cobb's stepmother, Sheena Cobb, told the Star Tribune while heading to a family screening of the body-worn camera video Monday that she doesn't know specifics about the encounter. "I don't want to blame the police or anything," she said. "I want to know what transpired. I'm trying to process what exactly happened." Kenesha Cobb confirmed that the felony violation referenced to in the state patrol statement involves an active order for a protection in Ramsey County taken out by a woman who is the mother of Cobb's 6 and 5-year-old children. "We weren't on the best of terms," Kashina Cobb said, "but we loved him." Cobb's friends and family took to social media Monday to share the outpouring in disbelief and grief of Cobb, who's memorialized in photos and videos dancing and mugging for the camera with friends. The State Patrol finished outfitting its department with body cameras last May, and troopers are now required to activate them during most interactions with the public, including traffic stops and crash investigations. Body cameras are supposed to automatically turn on if a trooper draws a taser or standard handgun. Troopers involved in Monday's stop had body and squad cameras activated at the time of the shooting, said Colonel Matt Langer of his agency, is working expeditiously to release the video after providing the family the opportunity to view it. In a brief interview, Cobb's father, Ricky Cobb, said the family is just waiting for the report in order to learn what happened to him. Events captured by the Minnesota Department of Transportation traffic management cameras unfolded about 2:15 a.m. on the right shoulder of the freeway about 2 miles north of downtown Minneapolis. Though video is dark, it appeared troopers were conducting a traffic stop near Dowling. At one point, the stop motorist drove away from the scene, and at least two troopers are seen running back to their squads, video shows. According to emergency dispatch audio, a trooper is heard saying, "Vehicle took off," and shots fired over dispatch audio. The trooper is given permission to pursue. According to the record, 2 minutes later, troopers called for medics, reporting 3 gunshot wounds to the abdomen. Cobb reportedly died on the scene. To the abdomen? Okay. MnDOT cameras showed at least 2 squad cars had surrounded the fleeing vehicle, a gray sedan, and had boxed it in at the center concrete median at 42nd. Minneapolis police officers are also arrived to assist at the scene. All right. Abdomen. 3 in the abdomen. This is basically... And nothing is cut and dry. It really isn't. But it does boil down to one of two things. If this driver was endangering the lives of the troopers by aiming for them, driving towards them, trying to aggressively do something, or if they'd pulled a gun, then it would be fairly justified by the troopers or police to fire their weapon. And I don't think anyone is sitting here and saying if a suspect is driving a vehicle and aggressively accelerating towards a police officer, that the police officer shouldn't at least doesn't have the right to pull their weapon and try to defend themselves. Of course they do. Of course they do. But what you don't use a gun for is convenience. He's starting to run. Well, I don't want to chase him. Bam, 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 bam. See, now I don't have to chase him. That, by the way, can I make the point that that is actually a god-awful reality of a lot of these stops where someone gets shot? It's basically like, I don't want to be inconvenienced by having to run after them. So here we go. I mean, I'll shoot him. And that's not what police officers are supposed to do. You don't just shoot somebody because they're trying to run away. You know, you basically and so I don't know. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see what the body cam footage shows. The fact I will say, okay, I'm going to go on both sides here. The fact that these shots are to the abdomen. Okay, so if I'm sitting in a car, and they're in my abdomen. you got to almost be shooting downward at an angle. I don't know how that could have happened if he was accelerating towards someone. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, you're going to have shots, you know, that are going to be more up in the upper chest, head, neck area. So shots to the abdomen, I don't know. It doesn't mean it's not possible. I guess it depends on the vehicle, depends on what he was doing. But that's a little bit of a red flag for me. What I will also say, though, is this. The fact that the State Patrol is bringing his family in right away to show them the body footage leads me to believe that the police know that they are justified in the shooting, and henceforth, you know, that's they're basically, you know, that's the case. It really is that simple. Whenever police start, law enforcement of any nature, start kind of putting up, oh, well, we can't release the footage. We've got to concern ourselves with the nature of individual. If all of a sudden they start hammering, that's a bad sign. It sounds like they were already bringing the family in to say, here's what tragically unfolded that day. Now, it doesn't mean that they're not culpable. Doesn't mean there's not going to be a lawsuit. Doesn't mean any of that stuff. But it does mean that they themselves are being quick. And by the way, can I just say to the State Patrol, I appreciate this. I appreciate the fact that here it is. Not even the next day. It's you're already bringing family members into seeing this with an intent of showing the public here, because it's guaranteed that the family is going to let people know what exactly happened there. So I think the whole point of this whole thing is that something bad happens like this, we want to know what happened. So on a big side of me, that leads me to believe that there was indeed a threat here that had to be stopped using the harshest measures. Could be wrong. We won't know until we see the body cam footage. But and there are going to be some cases, and frankly, that you're going to have some people that no matter what that body cam footage says, is that they're wrong and they shouldn't have done that. And I can understand that, but the reality is if he A, brandished a weapon, or B, he was using his vehicle as a weapon, well, the police officers aren't there to be bowling pins. They're not there to be killed, and that's just that. So 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205 is the phone number. I got to take a quick moment here as well. I want to address something that Rytos are somewhat furious with me right now, because I pointed out there's a story, and once again, good news, the Amber Alert that went off on Saturday night, late night Saturday night, that child has been found safe. 2-year-old boy, according to police officers, Saturday night were dispatched to a reported domestic call, the 12,000 block of Rolling Ridge Road in Becker. All right. When they arrived, officers located a female victim who'd been assaulted. The suspect had already left the victim's vehicle along with a 2-year-old boy. Police say the suspect is a 41-year-old man who had a court order barring him from contacting the boy. At 12:30 a.m. on Sunday, a homeowner in Baxter, so yeah, kind of going a little ways up north there, called the Crow Wing County Sheriff's Office reporting that there were lights on in a shed and they saw movement inside. Officers say the suspect has ties to the residence. Baxter is about 80 miles northwest of Becker. Officers arrived, set up a perimeter, began negotiating with the suspect. After several hours of negotiation, the suspect was taken into custody. The boy was found safe. The Amber Alert was canceled. Good news there. The suspect is in custody in Crow Wing County Jail, pending charges that include domestic assault, order for protection violation, threats to violence, and authorized use of motor vehicles. Now, I pointed out that, and this is where I'm getting some grief here, is because once again, I want to remind everyone, last year during the campaign season, we had multiple people insist that there was no crime ever happened in small town America. The only crime that happened in Minnesota is in Minneapolis, St. Paul. Bah! Please. And it's become back again because of the Jason Aldean country song, where it's like, try that in a small town. Oh, you mean where all the meth is being produced, sold, and being used? because that's where a lot of meth is being used and sold and produced. And I pointed out that, wait a second, you have Becker and Baxter. These are not metro area towns. These are towns here. And stuff like this doesn't happen in a small town. I thought they were all just square dancing, eating apple pie, staring lovingly into the sunset, and threatening outsiders and minorities with their guns, which is kind of a throwback to Jason Aldean, who was talking about, we've got to try that in a small town. Well, someone did. Someone did try that and tragically beat a woman who had a restraining order against him, stole a two-year-old child. And big kudos to the guy who up in Baxter who said, wait a second, there shouldn't be anyone over in that place. I'm seeing lights on in a shed. That's not good. The reality is that this happened in a small town. And you guys are all upset. Like, look at you take relishing this happening in a small town. No. I'm not relishing anything. I'm calling out your hypocrisy. The great lie. Nothing bad happens in small town America. We just took some sticks and made our own fishing poles and heading down to the fishing hole. And a little bit later on, we're going to help round up the cows of the town, maybe make some homemade ice cream while we sit and watch the fireflies off our porch. Because that's all we do. Outside of that, meth. Crime in small towns across the country is off the charts. It is. This idea that try that in a small town. People are trying it all the freaking time in small towns. And you guys are going to say, well, that's just Bill. That's just Bill violating the domestic order there, preventing him from seeing his ex or his kid. I mean, that's just Bill. Wait a second. I thought there was Oh, that's right. What you're only talking about is the black person stuff in the major cities. I see. They try that in the small town. Then all of a sudden, you guys are going to be stopping crime left and right. But you don't have any time to stop all the other crimes that are actually happening out there. The DWIs, the domestic assaults, the drug use, the tragically shooting of police officers that happens in small towns across the country. Dear Lord. Nope, you guys think that that's just fine. The cops should have probably not tried to do that. And that's your entire argument. No, there's tons of crime in small towns. I'm not relishing it. I'm just calling out your fake narrative that somehow Minneapolis-St. Paul is so much more dangerous. Bull, man. Because not only do you guys have more crime there, if you're a minority, considering there's so many white people looking out for you, looking for you to come into the town so they can pull out their guns and tell you, not in my town. It's far less safe out in small town America than it is in the major metro areas. And that's not me. That's just you guys. I'm just calling out your hypocrisy. Something I do relish doing. Because you guys are the most hypocritical bunch of jerks I've ever seen. Try that in a small town. They're doing it in small towns, and you guys don't have a problem with it. Well, because they're white. That's why. Hypocrites. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll come on back. I'll talk about the implosion of Twitter again. Why not? It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show. So let's talk about Twitter X. Can I first of all say this? You had a pretty good business recognition with Twitter. This X, as someone pointed out, I'm confused by it. It looks a lot like my Xfinity app, on the thing. Everything that Elon Musk does with his company almost seems like it almost seems like it's designed to destroy it. And getting rid of Twitter and putting out X because that's something he and his buddy liked, I don't know. Needless to say, obviously there was someone on Twitter with @X. It was Gene X Huang, a co-founder of event photo company Orange Photography. Person was originally registered with the @X handle. So, obviously, he's expecting a call from Elon Musk saying, how much money do you want for the @X handle? They didn't even do it. They just basically took it from him. Elon Musk just went out and took someone's handle from him. I got an email basically saying they're taking it. Huang told Mashable in an email exchange. He was waiting for them to contact them. Here's the generic support at Twitter email. Musk's company is within its right to take the username, barring trademark issues. Users don't have rights to specific handles according to social media companies' terms of service. However, with reports that Twitter had been considering launching a service where users could bid on unused rare handles, some users had thought the company would offer him something. According to the Huang, the company now formerly known as Twitter did offer an alternative handle with the history of the X account, so that the original account, complete with his posts and followers, could live on. So here is this was the catchy handle that Elon Musk said he was going to give me. It was not going to be @X. It was going to be @X 1234567899875. God, you're going to look like you're from Russia. So once again, here it is, you know. I'm here for the people. You're doing something I want. Gimme, 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 gimme. Sure. The other story about Twitter today, and this goes back to, you remember how back in about 2016, when racists were saying, I'm not the racist, you're the racist for pointing out the fact that I'm saying racist things. Genius. Okay, yeah, this is the corporate version of this. An anti-hate speech group is fighting back after Twitter threatened legal action over a study that found the company failed to remove hateful tweets from paid accounts. The legal threat from Twitter accused the Center for Countering Digital Hate, a nonprofit organization, of publishing inflammatory, outrageous, and false or misleading assertions about the social media platform, specifically in the form of the group's research into Twitter's failure to take down hate speech since Elon Musk took over. In June, CCDH researchers used Twitter's reporting mechanism to flag 100 tweets from paid Twitter Blue subscribers that CCDH saw as violating Twitter's policies, including racist, homophobic, neo-Nazi, anti-Semitic, or conspiracy content. 4 days later, according to the group, Twitter had only taken down one post out of 100, and all the offending accounts remained active. Twitter claimed that the letter... They had a reason to believe CCDH's work had been funded by Twitter's competitors. No, just they're looking at it. Needless to say, okay, let's make sure we understand something. I mean, behind me, if you're watching on the show here, on the TV screen, are listed all my other alternative accounts. I also, on Twitter and Facebook, you can go there, and I do have bookmarked there. I believe it's still bookmarked on Facebook. At the top of the page, all my other social medias. Go follow me somewhere else. Elon Musk did not buy this thing because he wanted to make money. Elon Musk bought this thing because he's a freaking idiot who got convinced by far-right zealots that he could basically control criticism against him, which clearly Elon Musk hates, is criticism against him. By shutting down Twitter and turning it into basically an extension of his id, and in turn going out there and bringing in the worst of the worst back in, racism, bigotry, hatred, and putting it out there and forcing people to like it. This is why when Threads came about, Elon Musk was out there making the argument, hey, wouldn't you rather stay here and be insulted? And that's, by the way, that's not an exaggeration. I would rather be insulted by strangers to my face. That's what he thought people wanted. The only option at this point is to kill Twitter. And what that means is, yes, I've got 3,700 followers on Twitter. I'm going to eventually shut that account down. And you can find me on Threads, in Mastodon, on Blue Sky, on Facebook, a lot of other places. But at this point, the cost to stay on X is too much. Native Roots Radio up next. We're back tomorrow. Till then, see ya.